Okay, I want you to picture this. It's April 12, 1972, a Wednesday. You're going about your morning in Utah. You've got five young children, so, chaos. You're trying to finish a master's degree, you have a job, and life is, well, it's busy, but it's predictable.
And then the telephone rings.
Right, the phone rings. And in what, a 10-minute conversation, your entire life doesn't just shift, it completely breaks off the path you thought you were on.
It's that classic before and after moment, isn't it? One minute you're worried about grades and getting groceries, and the next you're being asked to just dismantle your whole existence and move across the world.
Today, we are diving into a really specific, really intimate piece of history. It's a memoir called The Call by Sister Wade. And look, on the surface, this is a religious story about a family, the Wades, accepting mission assignment to Finland.
But it's so much more than that.
Oh, it's so much more. As I was reading it, I realized it's basically a thriller about logistics.
It really is. It's a study in crisis management.
It's about how you take a family of seven, keep this massive secret, renovate a house, and deal with international bureaucracy in a world with no internet, no email. You couldn't just Google how to survive in Finland.
That context is so important. We're talking 1972. If you moved to Helsinki then, you were just gone. You weren't FaceTiming grandma every Sunday. You were cutting the cord. And the Wade family, that's Bob, his wife, and their five kids, Allison, Laura Lee, Robbie, Mikey, and Catherine, they had to make that leap with almost zero prep time.
So let's get into the day it all happened. April 12th, Bob Wade calls his wife from his office. He's just gotten off the phone with Harold B. Lee. Now, for people who don't know the hierarchy here, what are the stakes? Who is Harold B. Lee?
The stakes are about as high as they get. Harold B. Lee was a member of the first presidency of the church. It's basically like getting a call from the CEO of a global organization.
You don't say no.
You don't say no, and you definitely don't ask to reschedule. They're summoned to a meeting that very afternoon.
So they scramble. They get grandma to watch the five kids, which honestly, that's a feat in itself.
Right.
And they head to the church office building. And this is where we get the first little crack in all the seriousness. They run into Marvin J. Ashton outside the elevator.
Another very high-ranking official.
Right. And Bob is probably sweating bullets, expecting some solemn greeting. And Ashton just looks at him and says, "Pull your hair back so you'll look older."
I love that detail. It's so human. Bob was young for this kind of assignment. Ashton is basically saying, "You look like a kid, and you're about to run a whole country's mission. Try to look tired or something."
"Try to look weathered, Bob." So they go in, they meet with President Lee, and the bomb drops. Bob's name has been approved by the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, basically the board of directors, to be a mission president.
But here's the catch.
Here's the catch. They can't tell him for sure where he's going, and he can't tell anyone he's going at all.
That silence must have been the killer. President Lee does hint that it's probably Finland, which makes sense because Bob had been a missionary there when he was younger.
Okay, so he had some connection.
He did, but nothing was official until a letter arrived in the mail.
So they walk out of that building carrying this life-altering secret, and they have to go home, make dinner for the kids, and just pretend like everything is normal.
For a full week. They didn't get the official letter until April 19th. I mean, think about that psychological state. You're walking around your house, you're looking at your furniture, at your friends, knowing you're about to leave it all, and you can't say a word.
And when that letter finally comes, the clock starts ticking. This is the part of this story that gave me legitimate anxiety. They get the assignment mid-April. Their departure date is early July. That's what, 2.5 months?
Less than 90 days. And the to-do list wasn't just, pack some suitcases. It was dismantle a life. Bob was in the middle of a master's program at BYU. He wasn't even supposed to graduate until August.
But he has to be gone in July.
Exactly. So he has to go to his professors and say, "Hi, I need to compress my entire final semester, write my thesis, defend it, and graduate 3 months early."
All while he's still working.
While working and while dealing with the house.
Oh, the house. This broke me. They decide they need to sell, obviously. But to get the value they want, they have to finish a basement renovation that is just a construction zone.
So picture it. Bob is writing a thesis on this crazy timeline. They're hiring a contractor to frantically frame walls and hang sheetrock.
Oh.
They're trying to keep the house clean for showings while living in a construction site with five kids.
It is the definition of a pressure cooker. And she mentions her family's reaction, which adds this whole other layer of stress. Bob's parents, they're active in the faith, they're thrilled, but her relatives aren't. And their first question isn't, "Are you excited?" It's, how are you going to pay for this?
Which is a fair question from the outside looking in, right? You're taking five kids to Europe for a volunteer job. It highlights that cultural gap.
Well,
the church actually covers living expenses, housing, medical, a stipend. But trying to explain that financial structure to skeptical relatives while you're stressed out of your mind about sheetrock, that's a heavy load.
And then the passports. I have to talk about the passports because this detail just screams 1972.
It's incredible. Today, getting a passport for a kid is a nightmare of paperwork and appointments.
Oh, yeah.
But back then, they decided to be efficient. Bob and his wife got individual passports for the kids.
All five on one document.
All five on one document.
I'm just trying to visualize that photo session. You've got five kids. From a preteen down to a toddler, how do you get them all in one frame?
I know. Imagine the photographer squeezing five weakly kids onto a bench. Okay, nobody blink. Look at the birdie. Stop poking your brother.
Yeah.
And they did it. One photo, five faces.
It sounds totally illegal by today's standards. Here's my group pass for these five small humans. But it worked.
It did.
They get the passports. Bob miraculously finishes his thesis. He actually hired a typist to work around the clock at the end. They sell the house. And on July 2nd, they get on a plane.
And that plane ride is the bridge between two worlds. They leave the dry heat of Utah, fly to New York, then London, and finally on July 5th, they descend into Helsinki.
And if they were expecting, you know, a warm welcome from the weather, they did not get it.
No. Helsinki in July can be gorgeous, but on this particular day, pouring rain, gray, cold, just miserable.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, no jet bridges back then.
Right. You don't just walk into the terminal. You walk down the stairs onto the wet tarmac.
So you have this exhausted family traveling for days. They're dragging bags, holding umbrellas, trying to keep five kids from wandering into a taxiing plane.
Mm-hmm.
And looking down from a window in the terminal are the current mission president and his assistants just watching this parade of chaos arrive.
Here come the replacements. But once they get inside, they learn this fascinating detail about the airport itself that just it completely threw me.
The prison labor.
Yeah. They're told the airport was built by prisoners. But not just any prisoners. Drunk drivers.
And this is such a critical moment for understanding the culture they were entering. In the U.S., especially in the 70s, the view on crime and punishment was very different.
Totally.
But here in Finland, the state's approach to drunk driving wasn't just sitting in a cell. It was labor. You pay your debt to society by building public infrastructure.
And the Wades didn't find it barbaric or strange. They thought it was brilliant.
Exactly. It's that first touch of Nordic pragmatism. You made a mistake that endangered the public. Okay, now you'll do work that benefits the public. It's efficient. And the Wades, being practical people, they respected that.
So they leave the airport, head to their new home at Makapelantai 7. And this is where the reality of the whole thing hits. The outgoing leaders, the Nelsons, are still there.
But not for long. And this really shows the grace involved in these transitions. The Nelsons actually moved out of the mission home and into a hotel for their last two nights.
Wow.
Just so the Wades could unpack and feel like the space was theirs.
That is a classy move, because the last thing you want when you're jet-lagged and overwhelmed is to feel like a guest in your own house.
Exactly. But the handover is fast. The Nelsons show them the ropes on the 5th, and by the morning of the 6th, they're on a plane home. The training wheels are off.
And almost immediately, they run into a biological enemy they hadn't planned for.
The sun.
The midnight sun. I think people sort of conceptually get that it stays light up north, but the reality of it is physically confusing. It's July. The sun doesn't set until 11 p.m., and it rises at 3 a.m.
Think about a child's circadian rhythm. You're telling them it's bedtime at 8 p.m. They look out the window, and it looks like 2 in the afternoon. Their bodies are just screaming, why are we sleeping? It's playtime.
The parents must have been losing their minds. Go to sleep. But the sun is up.
It was a full-blown crisis. One of their first most desperate errands was to go out and buy heavy blackout drapes. They had to physically construct the night inside their bedrooms to get the family to function.
But they weren't battling this completely alone. And this is the part of the story that I really loved. They had what I'd call an instant village.
They did. And it's important to note, this village wasn't just other church officials. It was locals. The real MVP of that first month was a teenager named Reili Itkonen.
A high schooler.
The high school student who basically moved in with them for a month.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine the trust that requires. You are these foreign adults, supposedly in charge, but you have to turn to a teenage girl and ask, how do I buy milk? How do I use a bus ticket?
It requires a lot of humility, right? You have to be willing to be the child in that relationship.
Precisely. And then there was Sister Parton, the housekeeper. That relationship is fascinating because of the language barrier. Sister Wei didn't speak Finnish yet. Sister Partnan didn't speak English.
So how do they even run a household together?
Intuition. Sister Wei describes this feeling of just stepping back.
Yeah.
Sister Partnan would come in, see what needed to be done, and just do it. She cooked, she cleaned, she organized. They communicated through the work itself. Mm. It's a reminder that we don't always need words to cooperate.
But words, or the lack of them, were still a huge source of anxiety, especially for the kids. We have to talk about that first Sunday at church.
This is such a pivotal scene. Yeah. So Bob, the dad, he's okay. He served a mission there as a kid. His Finnish comes back pretty fast. He stands up and speaks, and the locals are impressed.
But his wife and the five kids...
They're sitting in the pews, completely lost. It's just wall-to-wall noise, alien sounds.
Oh.
The kids are looking around, probably terrified, thinking, is this our life now? Just sitting in a room for hours, not knowing what's going on?
Yeah.
And then the sacrament service begins, the blessing of the bread and water.
Yeah.
And Sister Wade writes about this profound realization. The words were different, yes, but the ritual was identical.
The rhythm of it.
The rhythm of the prayer, the way the trays were passed, the silence. It was an anchor, a realization that they weren't actually strangers. The language of the ritual transcended the language of the country.
It gave them a foothold. Okay, I don't know the word for bread yet, but I know what this means. So they have a spiritual foothold. Now they need a cultural one. And in Finland, there's really only one way to truly integrate.
The sauna.
You have to get naked and sit in a hot room.
You cannot escape the sauna.
And they had one right in their apartment, which is the ultimate luxury. But for an American family in 1972, this must have been a weird concept.
Very weird. But they had a guide. A former missionary named Eric Erickson was staying with them, and he introduced the kids to the protocol. You don't just sit there. You throw water on the rocks, the luwaili.
Yeah.
You sweat, you wash.
And then the best part, the post-sauna snack.
The culinary integration.
Right.
He introduced them to makara, which is sausage, and a soda called pomak.
I looked this up. Pomak is a fruit soda that's aged in oak barrels. It sounds kind of sophisticated.
It's very Finnish. But for those kids sitting there clean and hot from the sauna, eating sausage, and drinking this weird barrel-aged soda, yeah, that's the moment Finland stops being that scary place we moved to.
Yeah.
Starts being home.
Erickson also gave them a crash course in pronunciation on a road trip, right?
He did. They all piled into this big Ford station wagon, which must have looked like a tank on those Finnish roads, to drive to the city of Turku.
Turku?
To surprise Bob at a conference. And the whole way there, Eric is teaching the kids how to roll their R's.
Turku! Turku!
Exactly. Just a car full of Americans chanting at the top of their lungs. But again, it's about that willingness. They were trying. And when you try to speak the language, even if you're terrible at it, people open up.
Sister Wade found her own little rituals, too. She discovered the Stockmann department store.
An institution in Helsinki.
And specifically, the soft-serve ice cream. One marka for a cone. It became their weekly treat. And I think when you're an expat, you need that one predictable comfort.
Mm.
I might not understand the news, but I understand this vanilla cone.
It regulates the nervous system. And she started getting braver. She learned that magic phrase, puteko inlantia.
Do you speak English?
And she found that generally people wanted to help. She wasn't isolated. She was just in a place where she had to ask.
She actually built a really interesting social circle right in their apartment building. It wasn't just church people.
No, and this is really significant. The building at Mäkipalantti had three other families. There were two doctors, and there was a man named Mr. Hevelina, who was a rovastier, a high-ranking dean in the Lutheran church.
I love that. The Mormon mission president and the Lutheran dean living next door.
Yeah, they became friends. The women in the building asked Sister Wade to teach them English. So they started this little book club. They'd meet weekly, read short stories, and work on pronunciation.
It just shows that people are people. You strip away the titles and the theology, and you just have neighbors who want to chat.
And the Havelina daughters would come over and read picture books to the Wade kids. It bridged the gap.
Mm.
But I don't want to paint this as a complete fairy tale. The setting itself had a bit of a dark side.
The forest.
Right. Their apartment looked out over this stunning pine forest. In the late summer, it was full of wild blueberries, strawberries, raspberries. The family would go out and just fill buckets.
Sounds idyllic.
It is. But they were also given a strict warning. Do not let the children wander into the woods alone.
Why? Bears.
Drunks. The woods were a gathering place for alcoholics who had nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this stark duality right outside their window. The innocent abundance of berries and the social reality of addiction hiding in the trees.
Wow.
They had to navigate both. It wasn't a curated experience. It was real life.
And then the seasons changed. They'd conquered the midnight sun. They'd picked the berries. And I assume they were bracing for the legendary Finnish winter?
They were. They brought all these heavy clothes from Utah.
Yeah.
But then Christmas comes, and it's green.
No snow.
No snow. Just dark and wet. It was a huge letdown for the kids.
Yeah.
But when the winter finally did arrive in January, it didn't mess around.
The freeze.
The temperatures just plummeted. The snow piled up. And the landscape changed completely. And the image that stays with me from the memoir is what happened to the soccer field.
They flooded them, right?
They flooded them to create these massive sheets of ice. And the Wade boys, who were American kids just a few months ago, put on skates and started playing ice hockey.
That is the ultimate transformation. You start the story sweating in a basement in Utah, terrified of the unknown.
Hmm.
You end it skating on a frozen field in Helsinki, completely adapted.
That's the arc.
Yeah.
And when you look back at everything they went through, the thesis, the secret, the passports, the language barrier, it really forces you to ask, what made it work?
It wasn't just the logistics. I mean, they survived the logistics, but that's not what made it a home.
No. It was the connections. It was Rayleigh, the teenager. It was the neighbor reading English stories. It was the Lutheran dean next door. It was the lady selling ice cream for one marca.
It makes you realize that mission in this context isn't just about, you know, preaching or leading. It's about enduring the discomfort of being new long enough to let people help you.
That's a beautiful way to put it. You have to be vulnerable enough to be helped.
And I can't stop thinking about your point on the language barrier. We obsess over words. Sister Wade obsessed over not speaking Finnish. But looking at this story, did it matter as much as she thought it did?
I really don't think it did. And that's the thought I want to leave everyone with. We think communication is all about vocabulary and grammar. But look at the evidence here. They connected through the ritual of the sacrament. They connected through the labor of housekeeping. They connected through the physical experience of the sauna.
The words were secondary.
Completely secondary. You can share a life with someone. You can share a community without sharing a syntax. Maybe that language barrier is mostly in our heads. Maybe true understanding is something you do, not something you say.
Something to think about the next time you feel out of place. Look for the rituals, not just the words.
Exactly.
Well, that's our deep dive on the Wade family and the call to Finland. From one passport for five kids to drunk drivers building airports, it's been a wild ride. Thanks for being here.
A pleasure.
We'll catch you on the next one.